You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and our big conversation today is about income. Record unemployment has been seen in several areas since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, hitting in many cases communities of color much harder than the white population. Even before the coronavirus shut down much of California's economy, Stockton Mayor Michael Tubbs was pushing for the idea of giving his city's residents $500 a month to help get by. He calls it a basic income. He and the basic income concept are part of a new HBO documentary set to drop tomorrow, and Mayor Tubbs joins us now to discuss it. Welcome back to Insight, Mayor. Great to have you here.
It's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
So where did the initial idea for the documentary come from? Did HBO approach you?
Well, absolutely. I don't have time to pitch documentaries. Right. So Mark Levin approached me in late 2017, early 2018. About when to do a follow around and see what it's like to be a then 27-year-old mayor in a city as amazing but also as challenging as Stockton. And at first I told him no. There was a documentary that was done 8 years ago and I ran for city council. And it was just exhausting to have the camera and the boom systems around. But then me and Mark had a conversation and I said, well, I'll agree to do it if number one, I'm just one of many characters and you really show the amazing people I get to work with. And number two, the story is told with nuance. So it's not going to be a story of tragedy. It's not going to be a story of victimization, but be a real story of strength and resilience. That's if you do those things, then I'm in. And I think after watching the documentary, I'm so proud of the work that Mark and his team did, but also proud of the city. I think it shows why I'm so passionate about Stockton and why I decided to come back to Stockton, because there's so much potential and there's so many amazing people who I get to call my constituents.
Yeah, there's clear passion expressed in the documentary. And it does, as you pointed out, focus on not just you, but there are several players throughout the piece. In the documentary, which I watched last night, you mentioned God on several occasions, and it made me start to think, how does the concept of basic income fit in with your religious beliefs?
Yeah, everyone thought I was going to be a preacher when I was a kid. That was my first sort of public speaking leadership experiences were in the church. And just from reading the Bible, just realizing that in the Bible, God speaks explicitly about justice. God speaks explicitly about the righteous care about justice for the poor, about the need for communities where everyone has at least a floor. So I think that part of my work in terms of elevating universal human dignity and making sure that folks don't lack just comes from my faith tradition. I think of scriptures when, like Jesus's first sermon, when he says, the spirit of the Lord is upon me now to preach good news to the poor, to liberate the oppressed, to set the captives free. Like everything I read in the scriptures tells me that the amount of deprivation we see, the amount of poverty we see, are not ordained by God, but caused by the choices of infallible men and women. And we have the power to correct that. And I think a guaranteed income is a step in that direction.
You believe Jesus, if he were around today, would be a supporter of this program?
Absolutely. When people were hungry, he didn't say, go work. He took two fishes and five loaves and made sure everyone had something to eat because he understood that folks need their basic necessities met. When the disciples were fishing, he made sure they caught a lot of fish. So I think he definitely would be in line with if Jeff Bezos can make $13 billion in one day, there's no reason why folks should be working two jobs and still not be able to pay rent.
While the documentary does take a favorable view of your ideas, universal basic income is not without its critics. Here's a short segment in the film where that view is expressed.
It's a silly idea. You never want to pay people not to work.
It's like, why a utopia is never going to be possible. The same reason why universal basic income isn't going to work.
It's becoming an excuse for companies to not pay a living wage to their workers.
It's liberals that are doing this. Liberal management, liberal cities like Stockton.
And I could see you smiling as you're listening to those bites right there. Let's break down a couple of those if we can, starting with wages. If your idea were to ramp up to a point where many Stockton residents are recipients of the cash payments, what is to stop companies from sliding pay scales down appropriately or not appropriately, but in concert with that?
Yeah, I really struggle with zero-sum policy discussions. I think that we have to understand the fact that people make more in unemployment insurance than they do working in some cases. It illustrates that today wages don't pay enough without a guaranteed income. So we definitely have to increase wages. That's why a living wage, a $15 minimum wage, things of that sort are important. But I think we also have to understand that there's a lot of people in our economy who work that isn't compensated, particularly caregivers, particularly women or students or artists. And they deserve an income floor as well. So absolutely, we have to increase wages. And you could do that and have a minimum floor for everyone, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because one of the other points was a disincentive to work. You just don't believe there would be a disincentive at this level.
Well, just from what we've seen in the past 2 years in Stockton, where we see that the vast majority of people who can work do work. And I think I just want to emphasize that because I didn't realize that going into the pilot either. But most people want to work. Most people do work. If people don't work, it's because they have some sort of disability. It's because they are working at home and doing caregiving work, which isn't compensated, particularly women. Or it's because they're students or because they're children and we have child labor laws. But this idea that there's a mass amount of people who aren't working, who don't want to work, just isn't true. And what we know is that people are working and working two jobs, working three jobs, and still can't pay for basic necessities. And I don't think there's any honor and working yourself to death and still not being given the dignity to be able to afford rent or an emergency.
We should remind people that the money does not come from taxes. Where does the money come from?
The money in this instance comes from private donations, primarily $1 million from the Economic Security Project. Carol Tolan, a philanthropist, just paid money to extend the program. And the idea is to pilot or test with private dollars and then get to policy. But I think even right now, as we talk, there's literally bills in the United States Senate and Congress that calls for giving folks money during COVID-19. So it's not a radical idea. It's an idea that's there's actually laws that are ready to be voted on that would do the same.
How did this become your cause?
I think it's one of many causes. I think it's the one people ask me the most about because it's the most sort of cutting edge and on part of a vanguard. But I am motivated to be in government and public service because I just understand that a lot of the things we complain about, whether it's poverty, whether it's violence, are actually avoidable. That actually with the right investments and the right policy decisions, we could actually create better outcomes. And as someone who grew up in poverty, it's personal to me to really unleash the potential of everyone and make sure opportunity is shared broadly, because we know in our country, there's been times where this country has given things to people, whether it's land, whether it's college education, whether it's favorable mortgage and loans, but that giving has been given to everyone. It's been given to a subset of the population. And we see how much benefit that has had when you have such extreme outcomes based off race and class.
Yeah. You're now hoping other big cities in California will join Stockton in offering similar programs. Tell us a bit about the conversations you've had with some of these other leaders.
Yeah, so we started a group called Mayors for Guaranteed Income, which is a coalition of cities from LA, Long Beach, Oakland, to St. Paul, to Philadelphia, to Pittsburgh.
These are not small cities.
No. Well, Stockton's not small either.
No, no. 300. Yeah, no, I wasn't implying that.
No, but I mean, have cities like Atlanta, like real cities that capture the American imagination. And essentially we're saying as cities, we will pilot and test the ideas. We'll do the scary stuff. We'll take the heat. We'll have the arguments with the hope that we have enough stories, enough examples that the federal government will act as it has to do, particularly just given where we are today with this global pandemic, teetering on the edge of a Great Depression. Unemployment, like there's just a lot happening in the economy. It's going to take a bold New Deal type action to make sure that we're able to maintain being a prosperous country. So they're all committed to advocating for guaranteed income, but also piloting it and testing it in their city to say, no, look, it works or it can work.
Mayor Michael Tubbs of the city of Stockton featured in a new HBO documentary, which drops tomorrow. Thank you for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Based on the documentary, I know you're a very busy person. So carving out that little bit of time, we appreciate it a lot.
Crazy day today. Thank you.
To dig a little deeper into the concept of universal income, we're joined now by a reporter for the Mercury News, also CalMatters, Laurent Dussault. Great to have you with us this morning.
Hi, thanks for having me. Good morning.
So you were on the call right there as we were interviewing the mayor, and we touched on it a bit, but your piece titled Mayors for a Guaranteed Income goes further into this. So how realistic is it for these cities, including Los Angeles, the largest city in California, to take on something of this size?
I mean, I think from what I've gotten really from economics expert, and I'm a local reporter, right? So a lot of this has been based in the Bay Area for me. But what I've been hearing is that these pilot projects are important because they're going to be bringing in some data, some data that we've been missing. And so for any type of government to really start implementing this with public money, they want to have access to some type of, something that can be grounded in data points. And so that's what these pilot programs are doing. Now, economically, how feasible that is on a very, very large scale with philanthropic money being the main funding basis, that seems to be a little bit harder for economics experts to tell.
Is there anything like this in Oakland yet, or are they at the very beginning stages in the Bay Area?
Well, Stockton's definitely the first city that's closest to the Bay Area to implement a guaranteed income program like this. But actually today, Santa Clara is launching a UBI, so Universal Basic Income pilot project for foster youth.
Today?
So they're transitioning foster youth. Their foster kids who are transitioning out of the system are now going to be receiving a basic income. Yeah. So I think the idea is picking up steam. I think one of the main, I would say, deterrent is the fact that most of these programs are funded by private donors. And that's what's interesting with what's happening in Santa Clara today is that this is public money.
Right. Wow. Okay. So we do have some data. I don't know how easy it is to access just yet, but the Stockton program has been around for a little while, and Mayor Tubbs did touch on it briefly that he knows a bit about people maintaining jobs while getting this income. How much do we know from the only program that's out there right now that we can look to?
Yeah. Well, from something that would be research, peer-reviewed research, I would say not a lot yet. What we have is, and I've spoken to one of the co-researchers on the SEED program, and it was very interesting conversation. And what we have is anecdotal evidence that, well, first of all, the levels of stress are going down. People are sleeping better. And then what we've seen and what they have seen is that there really is no, from the SEED Stockton program, is that there's no deterrent to work. People are quitting their third job, sometimes their second job. And that is on very rare instances. And so I think that's probably a very interesting data point that they're gathering right now is that guaranteed income might not actually deter people from working.
And I imagine finding that right dollar value for that will vary from city to city. Clearly in San Francisco, $500 isn't going to go very far, and you would have to continue working, but it would change based on where you are.
Yeah, I mean, so that's something else that I think Mayor Tubbs highlights that is very interesting with guaranteed income versus that it's supposed to be an added benefit. It's not supposed to complete with, if you receive a SNAP or formerly called food stamps, right? You don't want your guaranteed income to compete with that. And that's something that Mayor Tubbs has made very, very clear. So I don't think the goal is to live off of that income, right? And so it would definitely, $500 in San Francisco is not the same as $500, in a rural area up north, definitely. But yeah, you're right about that.
How long is the Santa Clara program scheduled to go?
So they launched it today. We're going to have a little bit more detail further up today, but it's launching later around 10:30. We're going to have some more details.
And I imagine that they looked at which population is most vulnerable to, you know, having things fall apart around them if they didn't have this basic income. And foster youth transitioning from a home into, you know, supporting themselves would certainly be near the top of that list. There might be some other ones as well, like perhaps, you know, prisoners who, you know, just get out of after serving a long sentence and, you know, maybe need some time to get their job skills up to date or something. But some other populations?
I've heard about the homeless population, obviously, people most in need. You know, that's something that people crafting guaranteed income projects right now are heavily thinking about is what are those populations who first need it the most? And then second, where is it implementable? Where can we implement those programs concretely?
Mm-hmm. A conversation about guaranteed income with a reporter for the Mercury News and Cal Matters, Laurent Dussault. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And just after a short little break here, I promise it will only be a minute and a half, we will speak with, a civil rights leader, Dolores Huerta. I can see she's already on the Zoom call, so excited to talk to her about her plan for survival income. And then we'll round out the show with Cap Radio reporter Bert Johnson in Reno to talk about how hard the people there have been hit by the economic downturn. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm Randall White. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. And just a moment ago, we...
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
We interviewed Stockton Mayor Michael Tubbs because HBO is dropping a new documentary tomorrow that features him. And I realized that I never said the name of it. So it's Stockton on My Mind. That's what you want to look for. Stockton on My Mind. Civil rights leader Dolores Huerta is pushing for California's legislature to take up issues of income inequality this week when members resume work. She wants lawmakers to make survival income for California's undocumented community a top priority upon their return. Dolores Huerta joins us now, and it is nice to have you with us on the show this Monday morning.
Thank you very much. And I'm also a Stockton. That was my hometown.
Oh, so see, there you go. What do you think about the program that Mayor Tubbs has running?
No, I think it's incredible, and it's very innovative of him to do that. And in a way, he kind of predated the whole COVID-19 pandemic when we found that we have to bring money into the community, bring money into the income stream, and in his case, to try to mitigate some of the crime that was going on there and to help the really low-income families, which is, of course, what they need at this really important time. Who knew that he was ahead of everybody?
Right. Yeah. So you say the state's undocumented community has suffered the greatest economic impacts from the COVID-19 pandemic, which is why you feel there's a need for financial help and that California cannot take a back seat during this period. Help us understand what you mean there.
Well, you know, the undocumented workers are not eligible for unemployment insurance at all because the money comes in from the federal government to the states. And Governor Newsom, as you know, in the state of California, they were able to issue a $500 per individual, maybe $1,000 if it's a partner, money to undocumented. But you know what? It just didn't go far enough. It was a one-time event. I understand that they've been able to get a little bit more funding right now to be able to help the undocumented people. And it's really, really tragic, especially when you think of the essential workers like farm workers, home care workers, child care workers. A lot of the undocumented people do this kind of work. And even with farm workers, and one might say, well, the farm workers are working, as we know, every single day they're out there putting the food on our table. But when the, what happened, because children are at home, you know, the schools are closed. So if you have a couple that works in the field, then one family member has to stay home with the children. So that cuts their income in half immediately. And most of them are renters, they're not homeowners. So here they have to, you know, pay the rent, pay the utilities. And a lot of the undocumented people also that were service workers and worked in the hospitality industry, they are completely unemployed right now. They don't have jobs. And it's just really tragic. Some of the stories that we have heard from some of these families, and it's really, really hurtful because, again, the pandemic has really hit the Latino community very, very hard and the African-American community. And you have families where you have several members of the families that have, you know, gotten the infection of COVID-19, and none of them have been able to get any kind of income. Mm. So, you know, they're depending on food banks and people to, you know, gather food for them. So it's a very terrible situation.
Dolores, because these people are undocumented, how difficult is it to get data, to get the data to find out how many are affected, what their financial situation is, all of that, you know, everything that would surround supporting this?
Yeah, it's very, very hard because, of course, there's a lot of fear in the community. You know, they get constant attacks from the Trump administration, and they know people that have been deported. And so they're sometimes afraid to come forward. We, with my foundation, the Dolores Huerta Foundation, we have offices scattered throughout the Central Valley of California and also in the Antelope Valley and the high desert. So through our members, we are able to identify the people that are in need. But we know that not every community has that kind of an organization. But I think this is where the community organizations really come in to fill the void that the government needs, and to be the eyes and ears of our government to identify the families that are in need.
The state did have a relief program for immigrants, but that's ended. And if I have my information correctly, you believe that didn't go far enough to begin with?
Oh, no, it didn't. In fact, I think the whole system crashed. So many people were trying to get on. People, we have had reports that people never were able to get a call back, you know, that then it's just the whole thing ended and many people were left without any kind of assistance. And I have to say that we do appreciate that our state legislators are trying to do the best that they can. You know, they are struggling right now. Thanks to Governor Jerry Brown, that we did have a surplus in the state of California, and we're having to dig more and more into that surplus. And now with all the businesses being shut down, there's less money coming into our state revenues. So we know that this is a very hard time for everybody. But on the other hand, we've got to dig in, and we've got to be able to support these very essential workers and the documented workers that really do the hard work to keep our society fed, safe, and sound.
So do you have lawmakers willing to take up your cause right now?
Well, we have some, especially I want to call out Senator Maria Elena Durazo, who is our state senator, former labor leader, international vice president of Unite Here, the Hotel Workers Union, who has been a big champion. But along with Maria Elena Durazo, we have many, many other people, both in the state Senate and in the state assembly, that really, really champion the cause of undocumented workers.
And it's not just your organization. You're being joined by others who are helping to usher this through.
Oh, yes, yes. We have a large group called Building Healthy Communities, that we have a lot of organizations that belong to that, both in Kern County, Tulare County, Fresno County, and up the state, up to the San Joaquin area where Michael Tubbs is at. And so we have a lot of people that are working. There's a group called the Safety for All Net. And it's got 120 organizations that belong to it. And we're also part of the Healthy Families and also Ending Child Poverty. And this organization, we have over 200 organizations that belong to that, the End Child Poverty Campaign, run by Conway Collis.
Dolores, what do you see as your largest obstacle in having this become reality?
Well, I guess we could say the budget. You know, that people are really concerned about how much money we have to pour into the income stream, you might say, to keep everything going, to keep people safe, to keep people healthy. And I guess the biggest challenge too is that more people are getting sick, and we just have to say to everybody, please, 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 use your face mask, social distance. You know, stay home if you possibly can, and you know, be very, very cautious, because if we can end this pandemic, then we can get things back to normal. Although I think back to normal is not the way we want it for our undocumented people. We have to, you know, get immigration reform. We have to get everybody covered by health care, get everybody covered so they can all receive unemployment insurance when they need it. And these are some of the measures that we have to take. We have to kind of reimagine. We have to rethink the way we do our economic business to make sure that everybody is covered and that everybody is safe and everybody can be taken care of in terms of their health care needs and education.
Cap Radio will be carrying special NPR coverage this morning, starting at 10 o'clock of ceremonies in Washington, D.C. for the late Congressman John Lewis. And I'm wondering, Dolores, did you ever get a chance to meet or work with Representative Lewis?
Yes, I just had the good fortune that I knew John Lewis many, many years ago, and I was able to actually cross that bridge with him on two different occasions.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And when we had the big celebration when President Obama, I think it was last year or the year before that, that I was able to be there with John Lewis. And most recently, I was with him with Ethel Kennedy and Kerry Kennedy at the Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights Awards in Washington last year. So we were together. And of course, at the Democratic Convention, I have some great pictures and great videos with John Lewis, and we won't miss him. And of course, we invite everybody to follow his path. We've got to cover this bridge. We've got to take this bridge forward until we can get the kind of racial equality, economic equality that our country needs.
Civil rights leader Dolores Huerta, she's pushing for survival income for California's undocumented community. Thank you so much for making time this morning.
Oh, you're welcome, sir. Thank you.
Cap Radio's Bert Johnson joins us now from Reno, a city that has been hard hit in a state that's been hard hit by the coronavirus pandemic because it is a major service industry driven economy in Nevada. Bert, what does income inequality look like right now there?
Hey, good morning, Randall. Income inequality is pretty stark in Reno and also the whole state of Nevada, actually, because, you know, this state really relies heavily on tourism. Almost half of the state's general fund, so, you know, the tax money that goes towards education and healthcare, et cetera, a lot of that comes from sales tax and also taxes on casino winnings. Mm-hmm. And according to the Nevada Department of Employment, Training, and Rehabilitation, which we all call DETR, almost 90% of Nevadans work in the service industry.
9 out of 10 people that are employed in Nevada work in the service industry.
That's right. That's right. And of course, those jobs tend to be less well paid than white collar careers, but also they're not as well paid as many jobs in the trades either. Mm. And a lot of casino and hotel workers are unionized, especially in Southern Nevada. And that helps offset the income disparity a little bit. But working at a casino resort, you know, before the recession was considered a good, stable job, and they're not quite as stable as they used to be. Mm-hmm. According to a 2019 study by the Kenny Gwynn Center for Policy Priorities, income inequality has been rising in Nevada. So they found that after the recession, the highest paid residents in the state were earning a larger percent of overall wages. Their share of the total earnings went up from 6.9% to 8.8%.
So during that period, the poor were getting poorer and the rich were getting richer.
Yeah, essentially that's what happened. Mm-hmm. On top of that, the authors of the study found that the overall economy had still not fully recovered from the Great Recession. So for example, in 2007, Nevada's median household income was just under $64,000. But in 2017, 10 years later, it was just over $55,000.
The median income.
That's right, mm-hmm. Yeah, for households. And that's a big drop. But back then, the state's overall economy was growing. So, you know, I did a story in January about the Reno Tahoe International Airport because they had announced their passenger numbers were back to those pre-recession highs. They were even adding flights to their schedule at that point. But now, thanks to the pandemic, all of that progress has been erased.
So did this study, Bert, look at how people working in Nevada were doing? Were they seeing the benefits of that growth?
Not really. unfortunately. Economic growth was concentrated among the top 10% of earners in the state.
Wow. So, okay, with that background in mind, how has Nevada held up to COVID-19? I'm guessing not well.
That is an accurate guess, unfortunately. Basically, Nevada has been one of the states where the pandemic hit the hardest. Since we rely so much on tourism, which, you know, just to state the obvious, but it means we're relying on people who travel to spend money on things they don't need. So the virus has messed up the economy here in terms of declining air travel because of the illness and declining incomes. So basically, people are flying a lot less now and they have a lot less money to spend, especially since unemployment is up. Mm-hmm. On top of that, Governor Steve Sisolak ordered all non-essential businesses to close in March to keep the pandemic from overwhelming our healthcare system. That included casinos, which was a really big deal. I mean, that just doesn't happen here.
They don't even close overnight. You know,
that's
typically, right?
No, I talked to one chief. I believe he's a chief executive officer of a gaming group that owns the Atlantis here in Reno. Mm-hmm. He said they don't even have locks on the doors.
Right.
So it's very unusual. And as a result of that, Nevada saw record high unemployment. In April, the state unemployment rate was more than 28%, which is the highest rate ever recorded in the United States since they started tracking unemployment data on a national level in the 1970s.
Wow. So Nevada has clearly set the unenviable bar for unemployment. Of course, those numbers don't go back to the Depression, so we're not sure if maybe there's been a higher rate at some point. But at least since they've been efficiently tracking, we know that it has now set that level. Hmm. So, Bert, yeah. What are state leaders doing then to address the crisis? Because this is something they've never seen before.
Right. And so they just had a special session in the state legislature, which ended a couple of weeks ago. And just to give a little background for folks who are listening in California, the Nevada state legislature only meets every 2 years on its normal schedule. But as a result of the pandemic and the non-essential business closures, the state has had a $1.2 billion shortfall in its general fund. So lawmakers had to meet to rebalance the budget. Basically,
did they go back to Carson City, or they did this remotely?
Yeah, a lot of them did go back to Carson City, and they had some safety measures in place. Of course, it was really limited, the number of people who could be in the building. Everyone had to be masked. Mm-hmm. There were temperature screenings outside, but just a few days into the session, actually, someone in the building tested positive. So some of the lawmakers started joining remotely via Zoom after that.
I see.
But anyhow, you remember just a moment ago, I said the economy had been growing here. Well, just like everywhere else, we hit a brick wall when the pandemic, non-essential business closures had to be put into place. And by the way, you know, those shutdown orders did make a difference in the pandemic while they were here. So we saw new cases level off and the hospitals were not overwhelmed, which was a big relief. You know, in anticipation of the pandemic in Nevada, you saw hospitals like Renown, which is up here in Reno, turning their parking garage into an extra ward because they thought they might run out of space, like what happened in New York. But, you know, since we started our phased reopening plan, unfortunately, we've seen those trends getting worse again. So, for example, the hospitalization rate has been climbing since late June, and that still hasn't really slowed down.
Mm.
So
we're going to have to cut it off there, Bert, but lots of insecurity clearly still ahead for Nevadans. And I know that you will keep us up to date with your reporting there in the Reno Tahoe region. Bert Johnson, Cap Radio's Reno Tahoe reporter. Thank you for the update from Reno.
Thanks, Randall.
Mm-hmm. And that's Insight for today. I'm Randall White with producers Kyle McKinnon and Cynthia Lopez. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Chris Vera Phillips. Technical director, Mark Jones. Our engineer today is a new one, Antonio Muniz, thank you for being here. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. Insight's managing editor is Aram Sarkissian. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Randall White. So that's today's deep dive look into one single topic from several different perspectives. Now for an in-depth conversation regarding the news.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Of the day. From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White, on this Monday morning. Ahead on the show today, we're talking about income and what's needed just to get by. With unemployment hitting record levels during the pandemic, there are millions of us facing financial hardship and all that comes with it. Race often plays a factor in how this might be unfolding in your life. We'll look at the issue from several different perspectives. But first up this morning, an update on coronavirus cases in California and how the state is doing as it works to handle the pandemic. Anna Ibarra is CalMatters Sacramento-based health reporter and joins us with the latest. Anna, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
And so, factoring in yesterday's reported new cases, which was 4,400, the state has a 7-day average of more than 9,000 daily cases. And last week, it surpassed New York as having the most cases over time. Of course, we have a lot more people than any other state, almost exactly twice as many as New York. Are there any trends in the numbers that you're seeing this morning?
Yeah, well, the cases, you know, continue to go up rapidly. There was a bit of a drop in the number of hospitalizations a couple of days ago, but we're looks like we're going back up. Same with the number of people in the ICU. So those obviously, the drops are very minimal, but there was a drop a couple of days ago. But again, it looks like we might be headed up. Are trending up again.
Yeah. And of course, the most tragic of the numbers would be fatalities. Where does California stand there?
Yeah. So California yesterday reported another 79 deaths. So we're over 8,400 deaths at this point.
Mm. You've done some reporting on PPE, things like masks, face shields, gloves. Where does the state stand there?
Yeah, so last week, the governor announced, you know, a new deal for PPE or face masks specifically. And so, you know, he announced that the state would be acquiring another 420 million face masks, which include both the N95 respirators and surgical masks. And so the state, you know, the governor has made it clear that the state, you know, is working on PPE, is acquiring more. They are working on reinforcing their the state's stockpile so that they're prepared for, you know, another surge or another, you know, similar cases where you might need a boost in PPE.
Right.
But, you know, there are still concerns at the in the healthcare system about the number of PPE available in hospitals and clinics and, you know, for healthcare workers. So there's still concern about that, even though the state to say we have, the state says there's enough. I mean, there's enough even that, you know, they're sending face masks to other states. But still, you know, there are, although things have improved, I've talked to hospitals, they say things have improved since March. There are still concerns about nurses having to reuse some of these face masks.
Right, which we heard a lot about back in the spring. How are we doing with testing? I know we hit a rough patch like a few weeks back with testing times taking longer than they should, I guess. Is the state able to ramp up still as was promised?
Yeah, so the state does seem to be working on that. And it really depends, it seems to me, just from my reporting, that it depends on counties because some counties are really trying to, they're still offering some of this drive-up testing for anyone, even for people without symptoms, while other counties are really having to cut back on and following the state guidelines. A few weeks ago, the state put out new guidelines on who will be prioritized for testing. So, you know, that would include people who are living in high risk settings like nursing homes, or people who are hospitalized, people who need procedures, you know, people who are showing symptoms. Those people would be prioritized. Yet we still see some people without symptoms being able to access a test. So it seems to depend on where they seek the test. And really, it fluctuates, right? The availability of this testing. You know, if there's a high demand, if there's a surge in cases, then, you know, this becomes more restricted.
Right. So the governor is scheduled to speak today at noon. Cap Radio will be hosting that statewide coverage, and our very own Nicole Nixon will be the one navigating questions from reporters. So stay tuned for that. Any sense, Anna, in terms of what the governor is expected to announce today? Even though Cap Radio here, we're that tied into the press conference, we really haven't gotten many signs as to what he might talk about.
Yeah, I haven't either. So it'll be interesting.
Right. Yeah, I know. We're all sort of in the dark, I guess, until noon today. So Anna Ybarra is CalMatters Sacramento-based healthcare reporter. Thanks so much for the update this morning.
Thanks for having me.
The hot topic in Washington, D.C. today is how lawmakers plan to address the federal coronavirus unemployment benefits, which are scheduled to run out at the end of this week. Specifically, it's Republicans in the Senate. Song Min Kim joins us now, and she's the White House reporter for The Washington Post. Great to have you with us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So what do we know about the new GOP stimulus plan that's being dropped today? Has that happened?
It hasn't happened yet. We're expecting it sometime late this afternoon, perhaps around 5 o'clock or so Washington time. They're really pushing up against the limit here. Republicans and the White House really did want this proposal released last week because they know they are up against a deadline, particularly on those emergency unemployment benefits. But some new information today, what we know of from the latest plan about those really critical unemployment benefits, is that that $600, that extra $600 that people on unemployment insurance were getting from the federal government on top of what they were getting from their states, that 600 figure will be cut to about 200 in the Republican plan. And now that the thinking goes that Republicans believe there are a lot of people right now, while they are sympathetic, those who are jobless and are struggling to make ends meet, they have heard stories that say that people who are jobless are actually making more money on unemployment because of that enhanced $600 benefit. So they want to take away that incentive to remain unemployed. They say that's bad for businesses. We knew that money, we knew that $600 figure was going to shrink, but now today we have a better understanding of how much smaller they're going to cut that benefit.
And the plan that was introduced a while back in the House by the Democrats, that still includes the $600.
Definitely. It includes that extra $600, includes it. It has it run through, I believe, January. So there is there's a difference between Democrats and Republicans on a lot of things here. But that is one of the big gulfs right now between the two parties. And it's unclear how that's going to be resolved.
Sometimes we can get lost in the numbers, you know, taking a look at the $200, unemployment insurance that the Republicans have put forth in the Senate versus the $600 in the House. How far apart would you say are the two parties on the key policy issues, the guts of what matters, not the numbers, but the issues themselves? Can they agree that there needs to be certain things?
They agree that the economy is certainly still suffering and that it needs help. I think there's going to be general agreement on, for example, those stimulus checks. They're going to be structured, at least on the Republican plan, they're going to be structured similarly like they were in the last major package. So I think that's not going to be a major issue. I also think that the issue of the payroll tax cut that the president had pushed for, the president has caved on that. So that removes one kind of big contentious sticking point between not just President Trump and Democrats, but President Trump and Republicans. A lot of Republicans thought this was not a sound policy. So, but there will be disputes. I think Democrats are definitely insisting for more in state and local aid. You have a lot of governors, a lot of cities saying, we need more help. We need money to pay the first responders. We need to shore up these depleted city coffers. Republicans haven't been so willing to do that. They point to the fact that there is some unspent money by state and local or unspent state and local funding that was sent out in the last round. And they want them to basically use that again. And all they're doing right now is providing a little bit more flexibility in that, in how that money is used. But Democrats are going to really fight those provisions. And as with anything, Republicans have been saying this for a while, but they want to insist on liability protections for businesses, for healthcare workers, for schools, basically saying, unless there's gross negligence on the part of these entities, that you can't be sued for something coronavirus related. Right. And that's also gearing up to be a pretty contentious point between the two parties.
Hopping back to the stimulus checks, so we could expect, what was it, $1,200 last time per individual?
Yeah, it was a maximum of $1,200 per person below a certain income threshold. And depending on how much money you make, that $1,200 was phased in different amounts. The maximum will be $1,200. So that is expected to still be in there. And administration officials say that's actually one of the reasons why the president gave up on the payroll tax cut, because direct payments are, quite frankly, more direct. They get into the pockets of consumers much more quickly. They can get out there and, you know, buy groceries, spend it on rent. Whereas a payroll tax cut is just a very small amount in each paycheck that you don't notice. And that doesn't add up so quickly. And also, at the end of the day, only helps people who are on the payroll. I mean, we are looking at a record number of people who are filing jobless claims, and you need, policymakers are aware that there needs to be more done to help the jobless right now, not necessarily the people who are still getting their paycheck.
Yeah, there was some talk in the Senate by the GOP to lower that income threshold you talked about down to like 40,000 or something, but that idea has been ditched.
For the most part, I mean, the saying in Washington is nothing is final till everything is final. But
right,
the latest that we had heard from the Republican leadership and from administration officials is that it would be structured pretty much the way that it was in the last round.
And the plan that is expected to be released this afternoon, Washington time, is more narrow in scope, right? It's focused directly on just the key elements as opposed to a larger package that includes many other things?
Sure. I mean, for weeks, Mitch McConnell has been saying he wants to be laser focused on healthcare, jobs, and kids. So a lot of the focus has been on money to help schools reopen. So there is, I think that's going to be one point of agreement and also dissension between the two parties. I think Democrats and Republicans generally agree on the funding level to help schools. You're looking at about $100 to $105 billion. But Republicans have been trying, obviously led by President Trump, to try to push schools to reopen more. Now, the Republican legislation takes more of a, you know, a carrots over sticks approach and kind of encouraging schools to open by saying you can get extra money if you do this. The Democratic approach, they've been much more cautious on the school reopening. And it'll be interesting to see if that will be an easier piece to resolve or not so much.
And just in the little time we have left here, some basic lawmaking 101. So we have in the One House, we have the plan that was put forth by the leadership there, the Democrats. Now the Senate is expected to release theirs today, which is run by the Republicans. These two things have to match at some point, right? And then everyone has to vote on it.
At some point, yes. Okay. And that's the problem. There was so much focus this past week on the rapid and the crazy negotiations. But what kind of got lost in all that is that Republicans were negotiating amongst themselves. It's the White House and Senate Republicans, and also within Senate Republicans themselves, who could not agree. They kind of frittered away a week in Washington trying to get agreement within their own party. So now they have something, but they have to agree with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer on that front. And you're looking at a package for Republicans of about $1 trillion. Democrats are looking at $3 trillion. So that alone, how you reconcile that, I don't know. We'll see in the coming weeks.
That's right. Songmin Kim, she's the White House reporter for The Washington Post. We're very glad that you could join us today to get us up to speed there.
Thanks for having me.
Much appreciated. All right, up next, there's been a lot of attention paid lately to the city of Stockton, and more specifically, the city's mayor, Michael Tubbs, for the basic income test program, which gives $500 a month to several people, no strings attached. That and other programs are now the subject of a new HBO documentary being released tomorrow. Mayor Tubbs joins us, as does a reporter who digs deep into the concept of guaranteed income. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.